Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. Coming up in today's show, BBC correspondent Orla Gearan will be here to talk about her life on the front line and her journey to one of the most prestigious jobs in journalism. Also, we've got the spoken word poet Stephen James Smith, whose videos get millions of views online, and the remarkable story of 19-year-old jockey Emma Doyle. Our text number 51551. You can email Miriam at rte.ie and you can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. But look, before we start, many of you enjoyed the interview with Van Morrison, which aired just a few days before Christmas. People are still downloading it and either listening on the show's podcast or on the RTE radio player. If you haven't yet and you love Van the Man, then maybe you'd like to have a listen. He visits some of his best known songs, everything from Moondance to Days Like This to my favourite, Have I Told You Lately. Well, you can find the show by just doing a Google search or just download the podcast wherever you usually download your podcasts. Or you can go to rte.ie/radio1/Sunday with Miriam and click on December the 23rd. Well, first, though, this morning, a wonderful story from the world of horse racing. On Friday night, a young student won her first race at Dundalk just one day after receiving her jockey licence. She's 19-year-old Emma Doyle. She's also a business and marketing student at Maynooth. She won on a horse called Northern Surprise, and her post-race interview went viral yesterday as she expressed her utter delight. It was a joy to listen to, and she joins me now from Kildare on the line. Emma Doyle, good morning.
Hi, Miriam. How are you?
Oh, it was such a joy to watch that video of you yesterday. Tell my listeners, first of all, Emma, about the race.
The race really went to plan for me. It worked out really well. I planned on just dropping in behind and trying to learn a bit, get some experience for my first day out. And the horse was just travelling brilliant for me. When I turned him into the straight, I just got a lovely clear run and he really picked up well for me. It was great.
I mean, it was incredible. And tell me about the horse Northern Surprise. What kind of a horse is it?
Oh, he's a great old horse. He's 8 years old now and he's become a bit of a family pet. We've had him his entire career, so everyone knows him well at this stage.
And is it true he's almost like your dad's pet, that horse?
Yeah, very much so. Dad rides him out every day. He was a great horse in his younger days and he kind of lost his form in the last couple of years. But testament to my dad, he really persisted with him through his bad couple of seasons there and it's really paid off for me. So I have to thank him a lot.
Of course. And I think your dad's a trainer himself, Emma, is he?
He is, yeah.
Yeah, Tim Doyle, of course. And listen, when you were in that race yesterday, I mean, what, a day after you received your jockey licence, did you think you would win? Or like when, go on.
God, no, I was shocked. Honestly, it was a big surprise. I had no expectations. We actually had another horse from our yard running in the race and she turned out to finish second, but we really fancied her. We thought she'd run a great race and she did.
And when you're on a horse like that, Emma, and he's going, did he just keep picking up speed when you didn't expect it?
Yeah, once he turned in and he passed a couple of horses, he just started to really enjoy it. He just put his head down and he really grinded it out for me.
And from what age, Emma, have you been riding horses? I know obviously it's in your blood, but from what age have you been riding horses?
I'd say I was probably 7 or 8. I would have been thrown up on ponies and stuff at home. And then I was taken to a riding school in Thurles near where I live. And it all kind of started from there. I moved on to the horses then when I moved into my teens.
And of course, you're a full-time student down in Maynooth. But given your win on Friday, would you seriously think of being a full-time jockey?
It's very much a dream, but I have to be realistic at the same time. I'm definitely not going to be pulling out of college to pursue it anytime soon. But look, when I finish my course, we'll see how it goes. And if I get on well this year and things are right for me, sure, we never know.
And are you back to college soon, Emma?
I actually have exams at the end of this week. Oh.
So you'll have to study hard. Well, look, everyone was delighted. I think loads of people like Ron Nugent, I saw him kind of, everyone retweeted your interview because it was just a beautiful interview after your win.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe the response. I really wasn't expecting that.
Well, look, it's a joy. Great story. We'll follow your career closely now. And the best of luck, Emma, with your exams. And congrats again on your great win on Friday.
Thank you.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Well, Orla Guerin has spent the last three decades reporting from the front line for the BBC, including Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Jordan, Israel, Tunisia and Libya. She recently returned from Yemen and she's back here in Ireland for a brief time to visit family and friends, and she joins me now in studio. Good morning, Orla.
Morning.
Thanks so much for being here. I've been trying to get you for years to talk to me.
I'm not so easy to pin down. Yeah.
It's an incredibly exciting life, and yet it's obviously also a very dangerous life and can be a very upsetting experience, the work you do. First of all, do you find it difficult to do the kind of work you do?
I feel incredibly lucky, Miriam, that I have a chance to do it. I feel very privileged that I have wound up in a career that I love so much and that people have given me great opportunities. You know, first of all, here in RTE, I mean, it's such a strange and very nice experience to be back sitting in an RTE studio again after all of this time. I feel like I sort of stepped through a portal and went back about 25 years. I have nothing but good memories of my time here. And RTE, you know, in their madness, put a great deal of faith in somebody who I now look back and understand was rather young and inexperienced, and sent me off to Eastern Europe back in 1990 and covering the collapse of the Soviet Union and then later the collapse of Yugoslavia. And by the time I joined the BEEB, you know, having all of that behind me, it made things much easier for me coming into the BBC and getting into foreign news. There was a sense that I had kind of done this stuff already. And one of the first assignments the BBC asked me to go and do was to Sarajevo. And of course, I had been there already for RTE. I would say I was very lucky here, and I've been very lucky at the BEEB to have had, you know, a range of great opportunities over the years and to do work that I find really interesting and compelling. I mean, it does come at a price, there's no doubt. And I think probably as you get older in life and a bit more reflective, you understand the cost of these things a bit more. But it's a privilege to do it. And the other thing I would say, which I always feel is very important to point out, you know, in the BBC, for sure, nobody puts a gun to your head and makes you go to a dangerous place. I mean, quite the opposite. There would be more people, more journalists, more cameramen, more producers volunteering to go on frontline assignments than there would be space to send them. So it's never a case that they're kind of, you know, casting a beady eye around the newsroom and seeing who doesn't duck first. You know, it's not that kind of process at all. So we are very lucky in that the BBC takes safety very seriously. We do too as individuals. We have to, you know, we work in a team. So if there's a risk being taken, it's a risk that everybody is taking. And also fundamentally, you know, you want to tell the story and you want to come home. And sadly, over the years, you know, I have lost colleagues and friends in the business. So we're not at all blasé about it. We would never be. But on the other hand, I guess what I would like to say most is that for me, this is a choice, and I feel very lucky that I have that choice and that the choice is in my hands. And if the time came when I didn't want to do, you know, a frontline assignment anymore, I wouldn't have to do it. But I don't and never have regarded myself as a war correspondent. I'm not. I'm a foreign correspondent who from time to time winds up, you know, covering conflict, particularly obviously in the Middle East. You know, as we say, it's a tough neighbourhood, so there's usually plenty of conflict there.
But I was just watching coverage from Yemen, for instance, and I mean, it was superb coverage, but there were times I was watching you and thinking, A, it's so incredibly sad, and B, it's really dangerous.
I mean, Yemen, in a way, the risks, in an odd way, I would have said they're quite limited at the moment. It's not an active front line everywhere. You do run the risk that all the Yemeni civilians are running every day, which is being hit by an airstrike. And tragically, airstrikes have been carried out by the Saudi-led coalition on civilian targets, from weddings to funerals to hospitals. There have been notorious instances of civilians being killed in airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition. And one of the stories we went to do this time, which we particularly wanted to do, was in a place called Sada, a province in the north, which is a stronghold of the Houthi rebels. And it is a place from which they fire rockets across the border into Saudi Arabia. You know, that's the fact. It goes on. But it's equally a place where innocent civilians get killed. And we went to tell the story of a group of schoolboys who had set out on a school outing, much like school children might hear. You know, they got on their bus to go off for a special day, really excited. It was a big treat, particularly for these boys who live in a very poor area. And at about 8:30 in the morning, when their bus was parked outside a local market, the driver had stopped to run in and get some juice and water for the boys. They were hit by an airstrike and 42 schoolboys died on that bus. And, well, actually 41 died on the bus. One of them died outside. He was a little boy whose family we met. He wasn't actually allowed to go on the school trip because he had been on another trip the week before and his parents decided that they couldn't send him on this one as well. He heard that the bus was on the main street, that all his friends were there, and he came racing down to see them and to say goodbye. And he was standing at the edge of the bus when the airstrike happened. A little boy called Zachariah. And when we went to his house, his younger brother, who was about 2, was sitting on the sofa clutching his photograph. And his parents explained to me that he gets extremely upset if somebody tries to take the picture out of his hands. And there was hanging up on this is a very poor family in a very poor district, and hanging up on a nail on the wall, there was an outfit of child's clothing, traditional Yemeni clothing, which was new. And they explained to me that they had bought that for Zachariah because there was a festival coming up, but he had never had a chance to wear it. And we met another father who lost 2 sons on that bus. And his son was the one who had recorded video footage on the bus showing the little boys laughing, joking. And that phone was found after the incident at a time when the Saudis were still trying to say that this was a legitimate military target, that it was a bus full of Houthis who were either fighters or training child soldiers. And this child, in a sense, spoke from the grave with his own testimony on his own phone. And his father was an absolutely extraordinary man. And, you know, one of the things about Yemen that I think people wouldn't expect, and I wouldn't have expected myself before going there, is just the courtesy and the kindness of the people. They are incredibly welcoming and gentle. People were sort of shocked to see us. They haven't seen foreign journalists in a long time, particularly in Sada. But the instant response to that shock was not, you know, who are you and why are you here and you're Western journalists and, you know, not at all. I mean, people surrounded us saying, are you okay? Can we help you? Can we take you anywhere? Do you need anything? Every door that we knocked on was opened. Nobody said, you know, why have you come here? Everybody said, come in. And that's been my experience every time in Yemen. But I suppose, making a long story short, which I never do, what we particularly wanted to do with the story of the bus was, A, make it perfectly clear to anybody who might have had any doubts that these were innocent school children, but also to try and let the audience see something that they can connect with. You know, these are not little boys a million miles away that you have nothing in contact with. You know, these are little boys like everybody's son or neighbour or grandchild, with the same dreams and the same hopes and the same right to a safe, decent life as the children of Ireland have, but they don't have it because of where they live. We literally did move mountains to get permission to get to that area and tell the story. And all of us, myself and the producer and the cameraman, were totally committed to it. But yes, you know, you come away and you remember, and you should remember. You know, that's absolutely right that you do. And I think if you went to these places and you weren't affected by what you're seeing or by what people are telling you, then you shouldn't do it anymore, because you're asking people to speak to you about the worst things that anybody could imagine. And I think if you don't have some degree of, I would hope at the very least, of kind of understanding, I think that, you know, you don't want to leave people feeling worse for having spoken to you. You want them to feel like they've been heard. And I've always been struck over the years so many times in different places by the fact that people do want to speak. It's extraordinary. You know, you think you've gone through that, the last thing you want to do is sit down and talk to a journalist. But in many, many cases, people do. And sometimes it's because it's all they can do. You know, they've been robbed of a loved one. They've been robbed of a home. They've been, you know, brutalized by a regime. They've gone through so many things that you know, we couldn't even imagine. And all they can do is give their testimony. And all you can do for people is try and pass that on. I mean, our role does have limits. And was a wonderful piece by Declan Walsh in the New York Times, who, of course, is a countryman and a friend and a tremendous journalist. And he was in Yemen at the same time as myself, and he was writing about that dilemma about, you know, you're there as a journalist, but you're also there as a human being. And it is a dilemma. And sometimes, you know, you are in a position to help people directly beyond what you're doing in terms of telling their story, but many, many times you're not. And you have to live with that, and you have to live with the fact that you are going to leave and they are going to stay. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, people are very kind and they're always, you know, concerned for your safety and well-being. And I really appreciate that. But I also always feel that it's important to say that we have a choice and we have a way out. You know, unlike the people whose stories we're telling, almost in almost every circumstance I've ever been in, we have known we could get out. If this situation is too difficult, there will be a way for us to leave. Maybe not immediately, maybe it'll take 2 or 3 days. But, you know, there'll always be a mechanism by which we can, you know, E.T. call home and we can get in touch and we can say, look, we need to get out. And the people whose stories we're telling are not in that situation. So I suppose I always feel, yes, it's lovely and very kind that people are thinking about us and our safety, but really we're not the point. You know, the point is what we're trying to show. And it's our decision to go there. And you know, we take that on board.
But it's so important in a way, because the Saudis, they've been stopping crews and journalists getting into Yemen. But you did get in. How difficult was it to get in? Did you get in on a cattle truck? Did I read that?
Yeah, they stopped us getting in as well, but we found a way around it. I mean, I've made 5 trips to Yemen. 3 have been in the south in the government-controlled area. 2 have been in the north in the area that's held by the Houthi rebels. It's an immensely complicated process to try and get in. I would say probably over the years now, I think I've reported from about 70 countries. Yemen is by far the hardest in every single sense. The logistics are immensely complicated. You have to get a visa, first of all, from the what's referred to as the internationally recognised government of Yemen, what remains of it, which is basically based in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis certainly get to look at those lists of people who are applying. The Saudis control the airspace. You cannot fly into Saudi Arabia without them knowing. They have stopped civilian flights in and out of the capital, Sana'a, for the past 3 years. There are no civilian flights. So any ordinary Yemenis that need to leave for any reason, however urgent it might be, or children needing medical treatment, I mean, we've reported on some of them very recently, you cannot get on a flight out of Sana'a. There are flights out of Aden, but that's held by the government. So you have to cross from one side to the other. Some people are too scared to do that. Some people don't have the money to do it. They aren't well enough to do it. It's a 10-hour drive. But on one occasion last year, we were due to go in and there was a brief window where the UN were flying in small numbers of journalists on their aid flights. And of course, we had been trying to get in. And they said, yeah, we'll take you in. We had all the required permissions from the authorities, etc. We flew to Djibouti, which is a very long way, because we had to get on a flight in Djibouti. And we'd been in the process of planning the trip for weeks. And we got to Djibouti and we were due to board a plane. We were due to go to the airport at 5 in the morning. At 3 in the morning, my producer got a call from the UN, hugely apologetic, saying that the Saudis had grounded the entire flight because our names were on the manifest. So that meant that an entire flight of aid workers who had urgent business in Yemen were stopped from flying because we were on the plane. So the UN tried and continued to try for a few more days, but eventually we understood and they understood that their flight would just not be allowed in if we were on it. So we said, look, we can't hold things up, you know, take our names off. And we then did find a way in by boat, which I think the Saudis were not expecting. And we did get in, but because of the difference in the routes, we could only then go to the south and not the north. And every time I've gone to Yemen, it's you know, you never really believe you're going to be there until you're standing on the soil, because so many things can go wrong and they go wrong repeatedly all the way to the finish line. And I have to say, to be fair, you know, many other journalists have been trying with you know, some degrees of success, trying just as hard as us to get in and cover the story. People have a great sense. I find, Miriam, whenever we do Yemen, there's huge feedback from the audience and there's a great sense of frustration. You know, people feel like the story is being hidden from them. And it is, you know, not by us, but it is being hidden by the parties to the conflict, particularly by the Saudi-led coalition who impose such tight restrictions. Now, the Houthis impose restrictions as well, and you have to apply to them for permission. But I have to say, on this trip that we just did, we were in for 2 weeks and we said, you know, we have to visit X, Y and Z areas, and we were allowed to do that. You cannot get there without their permission. There is checkpoint after checkpoint. I have never seen more checkpoints in my life. So you would not get 5 inches up the road without being discovered. But, you know, once we said we want to go here and there, we were allowed to do it. We were allowed to speak to the people that we wanted to speak to. There were no restrictions on the material that we broadcast. We broadcast it while we were still in Yemen. They didn't see any of it until it went out, just like everybody else. There are restrictions, but you can navigate around them. But I think the most damaging thing for Yemen has been that most journalists have been kept out. And it has been possible for the warring parties to do that, particularly the Saudis. I mean, if you stop the flights, most journalists don't have the money. They don't have the resources. Mm. The organisations aren't prepared to take the risk of sending somebody on a boat across the Red Sea. I mean, the first time we went in, it was on a ship that was a cattle truck. There were no cattle present at the time. There were a huge number of cockroaches and a lovely crew who spoke no known language. We couldn't communicate with them. They couldn't communicate with us. But every morning they caught fish out of the Red Sea and shared their breakfast with us. We managed to get there. But sometimes, you know, you do have to use the unorthodox means to get where you need to go.
Do you feel, you spoke earlier about, you know, obviously you're a journalist, but you're also a human being, and how you divorce that when you see what you see on the ground? I mean, in Yemen, am I right to say that it's the biggest cholera epidemic in the world? 2 million Yemenis have been displaced. I mean, how can you report on that and stay unaffected and then go home and not constantly think about it?
I think the truth is that you're not unaffected, but I think you have to be professional and do the job while you're there. In a strange way, the kind of constant pressure of deadlines, I think, is a bit of a form of insulation, because you are so conscious of how much you have to get done in the course of a day. And particularly when you're away filming, you're usually racing from morning until night. It is rush, 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 rush. And then if you're editing, even more so. So you're constantly moving and you're trying to gather the information and trying to find the stories and, you know, find people to speak to. So you're under a great deal of time pressure. And I think that is a form almost of, I suppose, protection in a way. Mm. That doesn't mean that these things don't have an impact, but I think the impact is normally felt later rather than at the time. I mean, one thing that does happen, and it happens spontaneously and naturally, is that you always wind up talking with the people that you're with, and you all come home and kind of go, oof. You know, when you talk about things, and I think it particularly helps to talk about them with the people who were there and who saw what you saw. But I think equally, you know, you have to be able to do the job, and the job is to go there and get the story and tell the audience what's happening, not to tell them how to feel about it, but to tell them this is what's happening and let them make up their own minds. But I think it would be wrong to say that you're not affected. Mm. But you have to find a way to be affected but able to carry on. And you know, as I was saying earlier, I think if it got to the stage where you weren't moved by what you saw, then I think it wouldn't be right to do that kind of reporting anymore, because, you know, people have to be treated with compassion and they have to feel like they're speaking to somebody who cares about what they're hearing. You know, there are all of those cliches about television journalists kind of arriving in places and you know, behaving disgracefully. And I'm sure over the years, that's happened in different places and, you know, different people have done that. But it's not how we work. You know, you really want to give people a chance to speak if they're ready to speak. If it's, you know, a government official or a corrupt official that you're pursuing, that's a different story. But if it's somebody who is a poor, innocent civilian who's caught up in something, then the choice to speak has to be theirs.
Given the power of television news and the power of the BBC, do you feel a huge responsibility to tell the story of the ordinary people you meet, like the people you met in Yemen, that almost you need to tell the world what's happening there?
I mean, you do feel a sense of responsibility. I think particularly working for a public service broadcasting organisation, and I mean, RTÉ was no different in that sense. The ethos was exactly the same, although obviously the operation was on a smaller scale. But I remember when I started travelling in Eastern Europe for RTÉ, I used to always listen to the BBC World Service, and that was, you know, that was my Bible. And the first time I got sent abroad for the BEEB, I remember sitting in Sarajevo and I had to file for the BBC World Service, and I thought, my God, you know, I'm now the BBC World Service. And it was sort of shocking and terrifying all at the same time. And you know, it is a responsibility that you take seriously. I think the nature of the media has changed. I think the impact of the media has changed, even though the BBC is still, I don't mean to touch wood as I say it, but I think in a pretty unique position and has a global reach. But the way we consume and digest news is very different now. You know, people don't necessarily sit down at 6 or 10 at night here in Ireland or in the UK. Here, obviously, they'll be sitting at 6 and 9. But you know, there's a generation of younger people who want their news when they want it. They're very selective. They choose certain sources of news and not others. And all of that's worrying to a degree, because I think people can end up picking sources of information that confirm only what they already think and believe and don't tell them anything else. I hope we're outside of that. And the newspapers of record are outside of that, and other serious broadcasters like RTE, like Channel 4. But yeah, I would say the news landscape has changed. And I think something else that I probably have come to realise now more than before is, yes, you hope you have an impact with a story. And yes, sometimes you do move the needle. But I think over time you realise the limits also of what journalism can do. And I think the first time I really became aware of that was during the war in Sarajevo, because that war was on TV every night all around Europe, night after night, month after month, year after year. And it didn't change things. And innocent civilians were being executed by snipers on the street just when they went for water or for fuel. And everybody knew it and everybody saw it. Mm. So I suppose it's you know, there is a dawning realization over the years that you go and you try, you know, you hope what you're doing will have some impact. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But I think what we're trying to do is just provide information for people so that they can reach their own conclusions. And, you know, that may help to shape public opinion one way or the other. But as I say, it's not our job to tell people how to feel, but we do need to tell them what's happening and let them make up their own minds.
How do you protect yourselves when you go to difficult places? I mean, is there protection, or are you just sensible? I mean, how do you protect yourself in dangerous areas?
I mean, it varies a lot, and I would say it basically comes down to experience, and that's a group thing, you know, not just my experience, but the experience of other people on the team. And the most important voice and resource is always the local one. You know, it's the local driver or the local translator who has been in that area all their lives, who can tell the temperature just by the way people are speaking, who understands if we're attracting the wrong kind of attention. I mean, the safety and security aspect of reporting has changed enormously since I started. And I remember setting out from here, from RTE, to go to Sarajevo when the barricades were going up, and asking Tom McCochrane if he could put me, who was the security correspondent, legendary security correspondent, if he could put me in touch with the army, which he very kindly did. And they very kindly gave me a military green bulletproof vest, but without the plates, because they explained to me that the plates were an item of ordnance and they couldn't hand those over. So off I went with this green flak jacket with no plates. And a much more experienced American colleague and friend said to me after a few days, he said, you know, Orla, that's not going to stop anything except it might stop you catching cold, you know. It's very different now. I mean, all of the organisations, the major ones, take safety very, very seriously. I mean, sadly, we have to. You know, the attitude to journalists reporting on front lines has changed. And I think 20 years ago, we were seen as honest brokers and innocent parties and so on. You know, now we're fair game. Now we're targets, actually, in a way, particularly for kidnapping. So the approach has changed and we've had to change as well. And we would have a team of people in the BBC who deal with safety and security. They wouldn't be involved on every story because, you know, you wouldn't need them. But they would be involved in some cases, and in some cases they'd be heavily involved. And for example, when I was covering the onslaught against IS in Mosul, and we were involved in moving forward with an Iraqi army unit. And we were in very close quarters with them and hence with ISIS as the fight was going on. I mean, there was one day in particular where the two sides were close enough to throw a hand grenade. And we had a security advisor there with us, an absolutely great guy. And he and myself and the cameraman went out every morning with our wonderful Iraqi producer and translator. And we hooked up with these guys. Well, actually, we were staying with their unit in a kind of a disused house. And we trusted them and they trusted us. And we also knew that if something very bad happened, they would not run and leave us. They were a very organised unit and very highly trained. On a few occasions, we would have to stop because of deadline pressure, because we'd know if we went any further, you know, we just wouldn't be guaranteed being able to get back and file the story. And there were one or two occasions where we'd decide, OK, we have enough. You know, we don't need to go into the next building. We have enough with what we have. And that decision would be made by the three of us as a team. And we were particularly in tune. And we all, I would say, had the same threshold for what we were comfortable with doing and what we wanted to do. So it is a team thing. And if on any of those instances I had said, look, I want to go forward, but the cameraman or the security guy had said no, then it would have been a no. And equally, if the cameraman had said, I want to go forward, and the security guy felt it was too dangerous, it would have been a no. You know, sometimes you just have to listen to somebody else's instinct, even if your own is saying it's fine. So it is treated very seriously. We have a risk assessment process, which is very, very detailed. And it might surprise people, but actually before you go out the door in a place like that, all of this is discussed in advance. I mean, you don't just arrive in a conflict situation and tear off down the road to the front line as night's falling on the first day you've arrived. You know, that just doesn't happen. But that said, I've always kind of felt you take the risk when you take the assignment, in the sense that you can try and mitigate and you can plan and you can be careful and, you know, take advice and all of those things. But in certain places, things can go badly wrong, even when everybody has done their absolute best. And I think that that's, you know, it comes with the territory and you have to accept that.
And you mentioned earlier that you lost some very good colleagues along the way. Were they people you worked with or people like Mary Coven you knew? Or?
I mean, it's a mix, but one of the names that really comes to mind and the faces actually, even as I'm sitting here, is Simon Cumbers, who's a wonderful, wonderful Irish cameraman. And he was an extraordinary figure. I mean, he was larger than life in all the best ways. And I remember one of the last assignments that I did with him, because he worked a lot with the BBC. I mean, he worked across the industry. He was very highly regarded and highly sought after. But he worked with us a fair bit. And it was that awful tragedy of the sinking of the nuclear ship, the Murmansk, in Murmansk. Freezing. I mean, needless to say, freezing. And I arrived, I think the story had already, it was maybe 6 or 7 days since the Kursk had sunk. So people had been there already, freezing cold conditions, very tiring, very difficult to work with the Russians and the level of surveillance and security and restriction and so on. And I arrived in from Moscow and Simon was there and he came bounding into the room. Right, where are we going? You know, big smile, huge enthusiasm. That's who he was. He was an absolutely extraordinary guy and had a beautiful wife and a devoted family. And he's no longer with us. And, you know, there are others like Marie. I mean, I didn't know Marie particularly well, but our paths crossed. She was extraordinary. I mean, she was an extraordinary journalist, but she was also hilarious and great company. And I'm just reading her book at the moment that was written by Lindsay Hilsum. And it's a wonderful read, if I'm allowed to plug, because it captures her in all of her extraordinary vibrancy and commitment and courage and doubt, which was really interesting to me that, you know, Lindsay has told a very full story. And for anybody who's interested in the Middle East and in journalism, it's a wonderful read. And it's not just about how Marie died. It's about how Marie lived and everything that she was while she was alive. And she was an absolutely extraordinary. She was the bravest of the brave. I mean, without a doubt, Marie always went further, stayed longer, did more. And one of the last times I saw her, we were on a boat together going into Misrata in Libya when it was under siege. And we had all managed to get onto this boat that was being operated by the IOM, the Organization for Migration. They were going in to take out migrant workers who were trapped in Libya because of the conflict. And the boat was going to do quite a quick turnaround. It was 2 days. So we were all going in and coming out on the same boat. Anyway, we got in. She and I wound up staying in the same kind of journalistic flop house. You know, this guy who sort of gave us shelter and took us in, and we were very grateful. And our paths crossed a few times, you know, running in and out. And she had done something very typical of Marie and of Paul Conroy, the amazing photographer she worked with. They had gone out for a night in an ambulance. And that was Marie. Because where is the ambulance going to be except in the most dangerous place, responding to where the attacks have just happened? And that was the story that she did from Misrata. And I saw her in the kitchen of this place before we were all due to leave. We were trying to catch a coffee and she was there smoking, you know, as ever. She was a ferocious smoker. And she said, look, girl, I'm not going back on the boat. I've decided to stay, which was a surprise to no one. And she said, my room, my stuff is still all over the room in Benghazi in the hotel. So would you, do you mind just like pack it up and tell the hotel I'll settle the bill when I come back? I said, sure. So, you know, we were ordered out onto the boat by the BBC and off we went. And Marie stayed and I went back and packed up her hotel and we had a bit of an email exchange afterwards. And I said, look, the stuff is all there. And that was the last contact I had with her. And I heard her on the night before she was killed on Channel 4 and on CNN and indeed on the Beeb. And it sounded like the seventh circle of hell. And I remember thinking, God, I must drop her a line just to say, be careful. And then I thought, she's not going to have time to read it. And I didn't do it. And I'll always be sorry that I didn't. But I think Marie, of everyone, would have known in her own heart and mind that that was the way she was going to go. She wasn't going to make old bones. You know, she wasn't going to retire. And I think if you read the book, it's very, very clear that she knew the consequences and she knew the risks. And she was always ready to take them. Just an absolutely extraordinary woman, but great fun. Mm. And when I was starting out, she was already hugely well established. I mean, she was a, you know, Sunday Times superstar, but she never behaved like that. She was always ready to sit down in the corner and have a gossip and, you know, share a story and have a great night. And she lived a very rich life. You know, she was more than somebody who went to war zones when she wasn't in war zones. She led a very full life.
But when you heard what happened to her, about apart from the grief that you would have felt, did you realise then also that what you do is very dangerous, can be very dangerous?
I mean, I think we always know that, Miriam. I mean, I heard about Marie almost instantly after it happened. And I think for many of us, it was kind of unbelievable because there was this sense that she would just manage to survive every time. And I, just stepping back a bit, when I was in Misrata, I was there when Tim Hetherington was killed with Chris Honchos, another cameraman, another photographer. I spoke to some of the young journalists who had been with them and they described what had happened. They had gone out in the morning to a very particularly dangerous part of Misrata. I mean, they went to the front line, which was completely deserted, and they went with Tim and Chris, these younger journalists. And one of them who survived was saying to me, you know, we were with those guys and they knew everything and they were so experienced and so skilled and we knew if we were with them, everything would be fine. And they came back. They survived the morning. They got their footage. They came back and they decided to go back again to the same location. And that's when they were hit. And I think there is a sense, you know, particularly among younger people in the profession, that people like Tim or people like Marie were indestructible. That they knew how to be smart, that they knew how to take the risks and still survive. You know, I suppose the lesson is that eventually in the end, the risk can overtake you. And no matter how experienced you are or inexperienced, you know, you can just wind up in the wrong place at the wrong time. And you know, everybody understands that very, very well. I mean, I'm speaking more about it today than I normally would. I suppose in a way I'm a bit superstitious. I feel like you sort of tempt fate. But I also feel that, and again, I would emphasise this, you know, we have a choice. And much as it's, I appreciate people being concerned about us and I appreciate, you know, people saying nice things when we come back. I value it. I'm not dismissing it. But I also sort of feel, I suppose, in a way, a bit guilty. I feel like that doesn't, but you know, that doesn't belong with us. That belongs with the people who are there. So that's how I would always see it.
Well, you're very modest. You don't like talking about anything you've achieved or whatever. You're starting a new role in the BBC and you're going to be based in Turkey?
Istanbul.
Tell me about that.
I mean, probably in the departure lounge at Istanbul Airport, frankly. One of my bosses said to me, I want the check-in clerk to be sick at the sight of your face. And I thought, that's great. But it's a travelling role. It's international correspondent. It's not sort of geographically defined. So, you know, in theory, we might find ourselves tearing off anywhere from South Asia, where I used to be based, which I loved, you know, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Middle East, obviously, but also North America, South America. So, yeah, in theory, it's a sort of a blank canvas. It's a new role. But I would also hope to keep covering some of the places that have been so important to me, like Yemen. I mean, I don't want to give up on that story. So we will still be trying to get back in there.
What advice might you give someone listening who would like to be you when they grow up?
Well, first of all, I would say do not be me. Whatever you do, don't be me. Don't do what I've done. But do what you want to do and never let anybody tell you that you can't. And one of the best pieces of advice I ever got was actually here in the RTE newsroom from a lovely news editor who was there when I started, who said, don't take no for an answer. You know, he didn't mean that obviously in an aggressive way or a rude way, but he meant just don't take no. And it's something that has stuck with me ever since. But what I would want to say to them is, look, just try your hardest and don't presume that you don't fit and you don't belong and you can't. But, you know, I didn't go to top schools. I didn't go to top universities. In fact, I didn't go to any university. I went to the College of Commerce in Rathmines and did journalism and many years later went back to UCD and did an MA. And now currently in the Beeb, there's a very big campaign and a very deliberate campaign to try and broaden the outreach and broaden the base of people who are coming into the BBC. There's a really big push on to get people who are not the typical BBC person. And I'm certainly not the typical BBC person. And Fergal Keane is not the typical BBC person. And there are others, you know, to get them to say, actually, this could be a place for me. And what I would like to say to anybody, particularly the girls, especially the girls, is you can do it. You know, you can do whatever you put your mind to. There isn't a job out there that a girl and a woman cannot do. Yes, it might be a bit harder at the beginning, but hopefully over time those barriers are coming down. Maybe they haven't come down as fast as we would have liked. I just think you have to go out there and go for it. And, you know, don't let anybody tell you you can't.
Do you think the 16-year-old Orla Guerin would be surprised at what Orla Guerin went on to achieve?
I was very keen on journalism even then. I was pestering the local free papers. I was writing letters to the paper, you know, all of that stuff, kind of trying to badger my way into print. I never saw myself doing foreign journalism. That was never a plan. I never saw myself in broadcasting. I mean, I did the Rathmines course, which was brilliant. But at that time, and I'm sure it's very different now, at that time, it was very much geared to print. And the theory was, you know, you'll get a job in a provincial newspaper if you're lucky, and if you do well you can come and get a job in the Irish Press, for example, which was still running. So that was kind of the career track. I never did the 5-year plans, you know, unlike Stalin, and it all sort of unfolded, and I had the chance because of RTE's, you know, madness to do foreign at a young age and got bitten by the bug, and that's really what happened. And then since going to the Beeb, again, one post kind of led to another. I didn't plan it at all, but this is number 6. So I don't know how many more there'll be, but it's been, you know, it's been extraordinary and it's been very accidental in many ways. But I think the BBC is an organisation where the broadcasting landscape has changed a lot, and there are a lot more opportunities for people now than there would have been 30 years ago.
Finally, you're home in Dublin on a visit. Do you come back a good bit and you keep an eye on news in Dublin? Are you so involved in international affairs that we look pretty irrelevant?
Oh, not at all. I mean, I come back every chance I get and I love it. And I have very strong ties here. And, you know, you can take the girl out of Dublin, etc. So, yeah, I mean, Ireland is always hugely important. And I do follow things here because it's, you know, it's my country. I mean, I may have lived in many other places, but, you know, I was fortunate enough to have been born a citizen of Ireland, and that's been a great good fortune. And I've understood that particularly well over the years when I've, you know, the accident of geography. You see people who are born in other countries who are much smarter than you and more capable than you and in many cases better educated than you and will never have a fraction of the chances that you had. So I'm acutely conscious of the great benefit of having been born here. You know, not to say that we don't have our issues in Ireland, but I think having spent a long time in other places, I can appreciate a lot of what Ireland has. And I do keep up. I have my subscription to the Irish Times, which I really enjoy. You know, yes, very much the place of my childhood, the place of my early working life, and my old friends are here and family. But it's a new country that's taking shape. And that's fascinating to see. I love RTE News and Current Affairs. You know, I always did when I was here. And I think the quality of what RTE puts out, no plamos intended, you know, is extremely high. It's up there with the best of them. So when I come back, you know, the radio's always on. The radio's always on wherever I am. It's just always on.
Well, Orla, thanks so much for being my guest today. I've wanted to interview you for ages, Orla Guerin, and it's been a privilege, and stay safe.
Thank you.
Yeah, and just order so much love for you online. I would be here till tomorrow if I have to read them all, but I'm going to give you a few of them. Barbara says, so wonderful to hear Orla on your show today. I feel so proud every time I see or hear her reporting from overseas. What an inspiration she is. Another says, your heart would just fill with pride at being able to count Orla Gearan as an Irish woman. What an admirable and awe-inspiring lady. So modest, humane, and she speaks of the amazing things she does in her work with such a down-to-earth approach. Just bowled over. Well done, Orla. Another says, Orla and a few other journalists like Robert Fisk give us a real picture in the Middle East with truth and integrity, which is not coloured in any way. Well done, Orla. Keep informing us. That's from Catherine. Pat says, what an exceptional woman. Another says, Simon Combers is buried actually in my local cemetery in Greystones. Another says, hi, Miriam. Can I say what a wonderful person Orla is? I'm listening to the show and I just want to say thank you to Orla for the wonderful, brave person she is. Kind regards. I'll be here till tomorrow, as I said, so I can't keep reading them. Lots of love as well for Emma, the jockey we spoke to at the start of the show. People saying what a wonderful young woman she is. And actually, all of our guests today have been women. And we continue with women because, of course, today is Nullag na Mban, originally celebrated as the Feast of the Epiphany or Three Kings Day. January the 6th marks the visit of the three wise men to Bethlehem after the birth of Christ. Well, here in Ireland, its focus has always been much more on women. A day when traditionally we were allowed out of the kitchen to relax, chat and enjoy ourselves. Well, to discuss this further, I'm joined on the line by Dermot MacDonald, I&M Group Business Editor, who's actually at a Nullag na Mban breakfast here in Dublin in the Dean, and here in studio by Lise Hand, who is the columnist with the Times Ireland edition. Good morning to you both.
Morning.
Dermot, what does Nullag na Mban mean to you and what's happening at your Nullag na Mban breakfast?
Well, Nullag na Mban is my absolute favourite day of the year. It's my official start of the year. New Year's Day means nothing. And this has become a really important tradition for me. This is perhaps my 12th or 14th year at a very special Nullag na Mban breakfast that has been organised for more than 20 years by Ellen O'Malley Dunlop. This morning, over 70 women gathered at the Dean. You can probably hear the din still here, where we had a fundraising breakfast for the National Women's Council. But what we did this morning, which was quite unique, is that we had our first ever all-female cabinet meeting of 2019. Constance Gorbis-Markievicz was the Taoiseach, Sidney Gifford-Searle was the Taoiseach, Catherine Daly-Clark was the Minister for Business, Rosie Hackett, appropriately enough, was the Minister for Employment, Affairs and Social Protection. And what we did was we summoned the ghosts and the legacy of so many women who were absolutely critical to the foundation of the state, including, of course, people like Kathleen Lynn. And we had a first, it was a bit of fun, but we had an all-female cabinet meeting in which we imagined the legacy or what these activists would say if they were here in Ireland. So it was a reflection on the last 100 years, how far women have come, reflecting, of course, on 2018, which in many years was a landmark year for women in Ireland, but also looking forward to, you know, it was actually quite fun to be in power, all the women up there, but actually looking forward to what would society look like if there were more women in the places where powerful decisions are made, such as Parliament, such as our businesses. So it was a little bit of fun. You can probably still hear the din. There was songs, there was recitations. But for me, I think it's a really, really special day in the year where we get to celebrate the pioneers, the women who've gone before us and made it possible for us to be where we are, and also to celebrate and salute the younger generations as well. So for me, it's a very, very special and magic day.
Wonderful. Stay with us, Dervil. Lise Hand, I read your great column yesterday in the Times Ireland edition about Nullag na Mban. To you, it's very important too, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I think the extraordinary thing about Nullag na Mban is over the last maybe 5 or 6 years, it has developed organically into what was traditionally a festival that really was observed down around the south and on the western seaboard. And I've just noticed over about the last 5 or 6 years, it has blossomed into this wonderful celebration, and that tends to fly below the radar. You have restaurants and bars full of grandmothers, mothers, you know, grandchildren, children, or else just big groups of friends out just kicking up their heels, enjoying their own company, plotting, making plans, you know, chatting about things. And there's a huge energy there. And, you know, we see this energy from time to time, every time, you know, there is a focus on women. We had the wonderful spectacle just in the last few days of watching a whole new generation of women being sworn into the United States Congress. And, you know, you're just looking at, you know, over 100 different women of all different ethnicities, religions, every one of them full of energy. And I think this is, you know, we've had a rough few years, I think, as women. There's been an awful lot of, you know, a lot of, I suppose, conflict, and the whole Me Too thing took off. And there's a lot of people were, you know, having to exercise their own cast demons and deal with things. And I just feel maybe that there's a more celebratory mood to this year. And I think Nollaig na Mban is a wonderful way to kick this off.
Do you think that, Dermot, that maybe, you know, there have been some difficult years, important issues got, you know, settled, but that maybe 2019 would be a focus on celebrating womanhood?
I think there is. I mean, I think the atmosphere here this morning was certainly one of celebration, particularly looking back at last year, but also sort of, you know, kind of saying, acknowledging that the last couple of years has been difficult. And it was, even though it was only a fun, playful exercise to imagine the first all-female cabinet, when the, you know, when these ministers sort of stood up to address what would be the realities, like one of the issues that came up was Brexit and a fear that it would be women and children in Northern Ireland who might bear the brunt of, you know, if there was a hard deal or a no-deal Brexit, who might bear the brunt of that. And also a reminder that there are many people across the island, women, members of the LGBTI community that perhaps haven't enjoyed in some of the successes that we have. But I think really this morning it's just about actually celebrating women, and that's why I love it. But it really, I suppose, infused for me the importance of actually just bringing more women forward. And I think one of the really big things about last year was the amount of young women who are coming forward. We have two very, very important sets of elections, potentially three, but certainly two, in the local elections, the European elections, and potentially down the line a general election here in Ireland. And we're really wondering, will the gains actually of the past couple of years mean that more women will come forward, like those amazing scenes in the US Congress when women of colour, when from all different backgrounds, were for the first time taking their place. And for me, that's what Nollaig na Mban is about. I think in the past it was about women putting up their feet, but for me now it's about women taking their place.
Yeah, I totally agree with Dervil on this one. And I think, speaking of the local elections, I think one thing that might be worth everybody having a long look at this year is the government does seem to be rowing back somewhat on its pledge to introduce gender equality, gender quotas. We saw that in the last general election, that when they were introduced and how you know, the difference that they did make. And there seems to be a slight rowing back on their promise to introduce these for the local elections, which happen next May. There seems to be a proposal now to put forward a funding for a gender equality spokesperson, as opposed to putting in penalties in place for those who don't actually make the 30% gender quota mark. And I think there might be a little bit of pressure put on them that, because it is, as Dervil says, very, very important to get women into local politics, because that's where the first layer of decisions are made. That's where policies begin to be shaped. And that's where women then get the leg up to maybe run for the Dáil and or maybe kind of go for the Shannon. So, you know, I think this is very important. And I think that maybe Nollaig na Mban this year is actually used more for plotting than for looking back.
Well, look, Dermot
plotting relentlessly here this morning.
Glad to hear it.
Well, look, Dermot MacDonald and Lee Sam, people always say, if you can't see it, you can't be it. And I know both of you are an inspiration to lots of very young women just starting out their careers. Thanks so much for talking to me this morning. As Lise pointed out, all our guests this morning were female, and all my production team are female too. So my thanks on sound to Sheila Neveal. Africa O'Connell was the BCO. Producer Sean O'Gorman. We're actually going to go out listening to another singer, Camille O'Sullivan, singing The Ship Song. We had it on our Christmas Day show with Camille O'Sullivan singing Nick Cave's The Ship Song.
Sail your ships around me and burn your bridges down. We make a little history, baby, every time you come. Come lose your dogs upon me and let your hair hang down. You are a little mystery to me every time you come around. talked about it all night long. We defined our moral grounds. When I crawl into your arms, everything, it comes tumbling down. Come say